Judge Matthew Johnson has joined the established panel. I'm going to ask our marshal to call the next case for consideration.
Case number A230724, in the matter of the welfare of the children of IMS.
A reminder to each of you, you have 15 minutes to state your case on behalf of your client. I'm looking at the podium. It might be a little high. There is a button where you can adjust it depending on your height preferences. An additional 5 minutes will be reserved to appellate counsel if you choose to use that. Also, a reminder, indicate who you are and which party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your argument.
May I proceed?
Yes, you may.
I actually am going to adjust this. I don't always need to adjust things down for height, so. All right, that's probably good. May it please the court, opposing counsel, good morning. My name is Nicole Groneberg, and I come before you today on behalf of the appellant mother to respectfully request that this court reverse the order terminating her parental rights because the district court abused its discretion in finding that such action served the best interests of the children in this case. Taking away a child's parent forever, permanently severing that parent-child relationship, should never be tantamount to placing the dot on an I or the cross on a T. The best interest analyses in these cases is the gatekeeping element between decisions that are truly necessary to protect the welfare of children and decisions that arbitrarily forsake the very children that the law was enacted to protect. Under the law, the best interest analysis should be thoughtful and it should be meaningful. It is the single most important consideration once a statutory basis has been established. It is, in all of child welfare, the paramount consideration in these cases.
And specifically, what did the district court fail to do, or in what respect did it abuse its discretion?
Specifically, the district court failed to state a basis that demonstrated why terminating the mother's parental rights, in fact, served the best interests of the children.
Well, there's reference to the need for stability and to be in a violence-free living situation. What's inadequate about that explanation?
What's inadequate about that is, and I think the fatal flaw with the district court's analysis, is that even if the district court had denied the termination of mother's parental rights, the children would remain in that situation and would have those needs met.
What do you mean, remain in that situation? I mean, they would remain with the grandmother.
They would remain with the grandmother, correct.
How do we know that if mother has parental rights?
Well, we do know that because on that very same day that we had that trial, the father, who was also responding party to that termination petition, they did not move forward with termination as to the father. So had termination been denied as to mother that day, the case would have remained open. And to put a finer point on it, terminating mother's parental rights that day did not dispose of permanency in this case.
Well, we understand that, and we understand the balancing of the child's relevant interests, the mother's interests, and the court tries to balance that. And I struggle when we have this balancing, and the district court is then it's thought that there was an abuse of discretion, because it's real hard for us, not knowing the children, not knowing the testimony, not knowing the mother, to step beyond what the district court thought in after hearing all of the evidence. I mean, if you have any factor that stands out that supports the district court's abuse of that discretion, can you put it up the flagpole so I can kind of get an idea of where to go with this?
If I understand the court's question, I may ask for further clarification if I'm not being...
Well, I'll try to get to the point. I agree. You know, kids that are of a certain age, you can terminate the parental rights, but they realize who their parent was. They're going to see their parent in small venues. They're going to see the parent because they're still in the same small venue. So it's a harsh thing to have happen. But we look at this as an abuse of discretion, our reviewing responsibility. And what stands out as an abusive determination by this court in analyzing and balancing children's interests and mother's interests in preserving the relationship?
So what I would submit is that under the DLD case, the universe that is being reviewed here is simply that very succinct best interest analysis provided by the court. And in that best interest analysis, the court simply states, based on the findings of fact in the court's order, the mother cannot parent in the foreseeable future. Okay. The mother has an interest in preserving her parental rights. These are the RTB factors, because her children are her life. Okay. The children have an interest in maintaining their relationship with their mother because she raised them for the majority of their life. The only element that of the RTB factors that weighs against preserving that parent-child relationship is the very succinct, simple statement, and again, this is the universe that we're reviewing under DLD, that they need to maintain the stability that they have. And at this point, it becomes arbitrary to terminate parental rights when the father is clearly permitted to keep his parental rights, and it just becomes an establishment of custody with the grandmother. This is not a case where the children need to be freed for adoption, so considerations of adoptability are not relevant. This is not a case where there are relatives coming forward and testifying that this will not work, this family arrangement that was started by appellant herself when this very difficult situation arose with her abusive partner. She left the kids there. This started as a family arrangement. This continued as a family arrangement with no indication that appellant was obstructive in any way with that arrangement. And
so this sounds so elementary, but so what changes if we agree with you and we say the TPR was a harsh remedy, the children stay with grandma, dad is still the father. I mean, what changes? Nothing changes. I mean, the mother is still absent from the children's life. Don't they deserve to have some finality in terms of knowing where they're going to be without that being challenged?
Well, two things, and I think this is a very important point, and I appreciate the question. Number one, I think that the idea that permanently severing the parent-child relationship gives children finality when they know their parent is out there just doesn't contemplate what the experience is truly like for children. And so these children aren't going to forget. So now these children are in this, what I would describe as bizarre circumstance, where they live with their grandmother. Father still has his parent-child relationship with them. He's non-custodial because he also couldn't take the children full-time. He couldn't demonstrate that. But now mom isn't there. She doesn't have parental rights. It's that relationship isn't there anymore.
But mom is still the biological mom. What mom doesn't have is the rights that go along with being a parent. She can't move for custody. She can't be involved in their school things. I mean, she's still the biological mom. So I don't, that's what I struggle with, is because we take these labels and we say, okay, you're not the mom anymore. Well, yeah, you are. You're the biological mom. You just don't get the rights that you get. And that's what she's not getting, but the children still know she's the biological mom. She knows she's mother of the children.
Well, I mean, under the law, and I don't have the specific citation off the top of my head, but the mother could never take these children who were, I believe, 6 and 7 at this time. She could never take them back into her care under the law. In fact, if she were ever to be found caring for these children, that would be an automatic required reporting by any mandated reporter. It immediately becomes a child protection matter. It truly is removing this mother from her children's lives. Now, even though the mother was not obstructive with the grandmother and she believed this was a good placement for her children, it was the placement she chose before the government became involved and gave her a case plan and said, you didn't do it well enough, so we're terminating your rights. Dad did it a little bit, so we're not terminating his.
Well, but the children were physically abused in mother's custody, and she has absented herself from the state of Minnesota, didn't work, as you alluded to, didn't work her case plan, and had no contact for the whole year prior to the trial with her children. I mean, don't those facts support the district court's best interest findings?
So what I would offer on that point, and I do think this is the critical distinction. Are these cases about punishing parents for failing to fully comply with their case
plan? Or is it about
plan?
Protecting children?
Or is right. it about protecting children? And in this case, there is nothing to suggest these children would have any less protection if the mother was given the same treatment as the father and allowed to maintain her parental rights. What I would submit is that it is a common backstory in many American families that there is a parent that is absent for an extended period of time. It could be something like a tour of duty, where a parent is not available to provide day-to-day care. It could be a stroke or a medical condition. It could be drug abuse. It could be poverty. It could be conflict between parents and alienation. And in those cases, it could be that there's enough there for a statutory basis to terminate parental rights. But it is also a common backstory in many American families that a parent is absent for a period of time, falls on hard times, and then reemerges to play a very significant role in their children's lives, which in one sense could potentially happen, even if you lose your parental rights, but in a more functional sense, maybe grandma gets tired. Maybe she says, I can't take these kids anymore. Maybe the kids do develop that relationship with their mother, but now they can't ever live with her, even if she changes the circumstances. And if there is not a good reason to take that away from children, then it's an abuse of discretion to take that away from children. And the focus needs to remain on what's best for the children.
So there was another finding in the district court's order that we haven't talked about on page 20, that the children are doing well and thriving with their foster parents / paternal grandmother. And there's no credible evidence they are distressed by not having contact with their mother. Don't those findings support the district court's ultimate finding about best interest?
Respectfully, I would disagree that it supports the finding of best interest. An absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, I think is a starting point. But there was evidence that I believe was the last time the social worker met with the children, they spontaneously brought up their mother. There was other testimony from the guardian ad litem that the children did ask for their mother. And I would also offer to that end, the family did not support terminating the mother's parental rights. The guardian ad litem did not support terminating the mother's parental rights. And it gets to a point of, what are we truly doing? How does this truly benefit these children?
Am I correct in understanding that the mother testified that she's not presently in a position to take care of the children on a daily basis? Not doesn't have the ability to take them into her own home?
That is an accurate summary of the testimony.
So if the court were to deny the petition, then I mean, what is the prospect for future parenting by this parent?
So the court denying the petition.
To add to the question, I mean, there were five statutory bases that were found present, including palpable fitness, and those were not challenged. So we have to kind of take those as given, right, when we're analyzing best interest?
Those are not being contested. That's correct.
Right. So, I mean, as well as neglect of parental child duties, I mean, and abandonment, I mean, don't we have to consider that in the calculus of best interest, the conditions that were found to exist?
Yes, absolutely. The conditions that existed at the time of trial should be considered. But the question is not, obviously, if they meet a statutory basis. The case law makes very clear that there needs to be an independent...
Separate inquiry, understood.
Separate inquiry to look into if those circumstances, in fact, yield a necessity to terminate parental rights under...
But the best interests are informed by the statutory findings, correct? The statutory grounds?
I I couldn't speak to that one way or the other. I don't know of any case law that would present that proposition specifically. But whether or not they are, the case law is very clear. They are separate inquiries. And in this case, I think it is a good example of, I think in respondent's brief, it indicates, oh, termination of parental rights, transfer of custody, as long as it's with a relative, it's all the same. That thinking forsakes the lived experience of the children that have to live with a decision carved out by the district court's order. It is not all the same to the children that live this. And if these children want to reengage in a meaningful way with their mother, if she positions herself to be in that state where she could do that, we shouldn't take that away from these children unless there's really a reason to do it. And in this case, the father didn't support it. There was no testimony. The family wanted her rights terminated. The father kept his parental rights. It's an establishment of custody with grandma. This could be another American story where there is a period of absence because a parent has fallen on hard times and could reemerge in a significant way in these children's lives. We shouldn't take that away from them unless it truly is necessitated by factors that outweigh what they benefit from that prospect. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Mary Lynch with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, representing Respondent Department, Hennepin County Human Services. The department takes very seriously the statutory framework. It is not a cavalier choice, and I think the trial court's order here reflects that. The abuse of discretion standard also reflects that. The trial court engaged with the best interest factors, looking at the permanency, the need for permanency. The statutory framework creates a need for permanency. It is not a cavalier choice. It's not it's not something that anybody takes in any way that's not serious, and the district court's careful order reflects that. The issue is not just flip-flop between transfer of custody and termination of parental rights. But the issue is that those two things are equated in the statute under the current statutory framework. That is not the case previously for over a decade. Termination of parental rights was preferred because adoption was preferred. The reference to the fact that the children remain with the grandmother as a relative satisfies that statutory value.
Maybe that the potential adoptability of the children is not an issue here.
I would agree with that, yes, in this situation. I think it is relevant that the children are with a relative. It's relevant mostly because it satisfies that statutory value, and also the trial court referred to the fact of the children being with a relative as part of its analysis, best interests, in doing the weighing test and the related findings. I do think that the best interest, although it needs to be a separate analysis, this is clear from both the statute and from case law, it is read within the context of the court's findings overall. This is a case that presented with significant physical abuse of these two young children and functional abandonment, and then the court, in fact, found statutory grounds of abandonment once the placement started. The district court considered all of that when talking about the stability, the need for stability, the need for safety for the children.
Given the fact that the children were in a stable, as the district court made findings, both with respect to the children's best interest and its other findings, that they're in a good, safe placement right now, given that, given the guardian ad litem's testimony urging the district court to give mother a little bit more time, to be able to deal with her situation and hopefully get to the point where she can safely parent these children. Why don't the confluence of those factors suggest abuse of discretion by the district court in failing to even mention that?
I don't think the court did fail to mention it because the court framed a part of its best interest analysis as well as some of the statutory grounds analyses in how long the children had been in out-of-home placement. The permanency decision by the statutory framework ought to be made within 12 months of children's out-of-home placement. They had been in placement in excess of that by the time the trial started.
And again, I was considering the fact that they're in a relative placement, right, that is not expected to change even if the TPR petition was denied, correct?
Yes, that's correct, but the entire statutory framework regarding placement also requires the department to do everything that it can to have children with relatives, both for temporary placement and for non-reunification permanency, if that's the way the case goes. So to say on the one hand the department has to comply with relative placement, which obviously the department wants to because that is the best thing for the children, but then to somehow cause that to delay permanency would create an inconsistency in the statute that I think is not permissible. And I think it also goes to credit the district court's process and whether, and then this court's job and whether or not the district court abuses its discretion. The district court took into account both the conditions that required placement, so the as well as the time in placement, and then looked at that in light of what the parent was likely to be able to do going forward. And based on the parent's failure to engage in the case plan, indeed failure to engage with the children at all for nearly a year prior to the trial, the court did not abuse its discretion, determining that the mother was unlikely to change her circumstances to be in a position to parent the children. Therefore, the permanency decision needed to be made in terms of the statutory framework.
The record seems, or the district court's order seems a little light on the issue of a future threat to the children of physical harm. I mean, what was the county's evidence and argument on that? And was it focused on the mother herself or on the prospect of future relationships with abusers?
It was focused on the mother's ability to provide a safe home. To a more limited extent, I believe, the mother's own actions, if that's what you mean, Judge Johnson, in terms of her inflicting physical abuse on the children, but the ability to provide a safe home, which involved domestic violence, which the court referred to, as well as the physical abuse of the children.
So I think I understand. These are kind of general terms. Specifically, I mean, the district court never said that there is a risk that mother will physically harm the children in the future. Never said specifically there's a risk that the mother will have a relationship with another man who will commit physical abuse. It's with lacking those specifics, there's just a very general statement about safety. Was there more specific evidence by the county that the district court was alluding to?
The district court presented the conditions that required the out-of-home placement, which did involve the physical abuse as well as her own domestic violence experiences to a more limited degree. I think it was primarily focused on the physical abuse and then the overall dangerous home, and then coupled with her lack of engagement, despite initially agreeing that she needed services and wanted to work on those services, then her essentially abandonment of those services, and then her testimony at trial, frankly, which the district court did refer to, that showed a sort of a lack of insight into the conditions that would be required to present a safe home going forward.
Related to that is, I took note of the way the district court diminished the testimony of a guardian ad litem who said that domestic violence is no longer an issue. The district court said this belief is contrary to common knowledge about the nature of domestic violence and the court's experience with domestic violence cases, presumably other domestic violence cases. Is that appropriate to disregard very case-specific evidence about this mother, this family, by generalizing about, by bringing in some generalizations about domestic violence cases generally?
I think that the court was referring to the court did say it, the court's own experience, and so I think
that is somewhat notable. The record, right? I mean, there's no evidence in the record about other domestic violence cases. I take it.
I believe that's correct, Judge. Yes. However, the court was just one of the elements of dealing with the guardian ad litem's testimony, the guardian ad litem did not ground his testimony regarding the absence of domestic violence in anything in specific. So I think the guardian ad litem was referring, I guess I don't know for sure, but it seemed that it was grounded in the fact that the children were in a different home, which does not go to the parent's ability to provide a safe home. I think the child protection social worker did testify to continuing to have concerns regarding the ability to provide a safe home, including domestic violence by the mother, given her lack of engagement and lack of awareness that she demonstrated through that lack of engagement. And so that would be the sort of train that would connect to the record there. The district court did, and again, I believe I mentioned this before, so apologies for repeating myself, but the district court, in its order, was clearly aware of the possibility of an alternative. The court properly noted alternative non-reunification permanency in the form of a transfer of custody. The court noted that there was no petition before it, so absent that petition, it was not an abuse of discretion to not go into great detail to reject that outcome. The court, however, did acknowledge that and talked about the need for moving forward with the termination of parental rights as being consistent with the children's best interests, looking at that stability. It is a meaningful thing. It's part of the statutory framework. The children will, as this court has noted, and I believe that the district court noted, the children will be in a relative home, are in a relative home at the time of the trial and the court's orders. And will have relationships with family members. The difference is what the legal rights are, the legal statuses of the parent, and that the statutory framework makes the decision to terminate parental rights of an individual parent the focus on what makes sense going forward for the best interest of the children. I don't think that the record compels any other outcome, even if there were another reasonable outcome, that does not create an abuse of discretion. The district court here made a careful analysis, considered the issues within the statutory framework. I think it's very important here. The statutory framework continues to express those clear values that the legal labels matter, that the children's time in foster care matters, and that moving out of foster care into a different more legally permanent arrangement is in the best interest of the children. That's expressed via the timelines. The district court was aware of all of those factors in making its best interest analysis. So I would say that based on all of that, it was not an abuse of discretion. The district court's order should be affirmed, and we would respectfully request this court to do that.
I have a question about the second issue raised by appellant having to do with the admissibility of Exhibit 19 and, its limited scope of admissibility, I guess. So one way to interpret the record is that there is an agreement that any hearsay statements by persons other than the children that are contained in Exhibit 19 would be excluded or inadmissible, arguably. And so the statement, the conclusion by the child protection worker on page, I think it's 26, about mother's prior conduct resulting in harm, that's clearly based on hearsay, right? I mean, it could be her own statement, but she's basing her statement on hearsay statements of persons outside the department, correct?
I believe based on this record, however, Exhibit 19 does refer to, so that was the summary statement by the child protection investigator regarding the outcome of the maltreatment investigations. The mother's boyfriend was the primary abuser, and there were specific findings regarding both children and him. And then there was a finding, there is a reference that there was a finding of maltreatment regarding the mother as to just one of the children, and maltreatment by physical abuse. So that's referring to the department's overall obligation to conduct that investigation, and that investigation is based on a variety of factors that are summarized in Exhibit 19 and actually repeated again in Exhibit 21 because it's just...
It seems like a clumsy way of handling an exhibit to say you can look at... Here's the exhibit, we stipulate it goes in, but you can do this with it, but not that. I mean, it just... Is that because of the volume of the record?
The volume of, of the documentary. I will agree it was clumsy. And it was clear there was a exchange between the district court and counsel at trial, and then they did it again at the hearing on the motion. And the district court did make findings, specifically in its motion denying a new trial and other relief, went in and looked at that issue again. And I think, again, we need to look at that as an abuse of discretion. I think that although it is possible that the record, the stipulation could be interpreted as Judge Johnson says it's possible, I think it's also supported on the record to interpret it as being less limited and specifically just excluding those statements of the children via the third parties. So that would be just a small subset that would be excluded and the rest of the document would come in. Thank you.
Thank you.
May I proceed?
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start by directly responding to a question that I believe Judge Johnson asked in my initial argument. If the case were reversed, if the order was reversed terminating mother's parental rights, we would be in a situation where grandma has custody, full custody vested in her. So that is what would happen. That happened subsequent to mother's rights being terminated. That wouldn't be changed by reversing the termination of parental rights. Rather, the mother would simply be a non-custodial parent. So I want to address that very directly. That is what would happen if appellant's rights were reinstated.
And is that because of a court order in this case?
Subsequent to the termination of parental rights order, the court, prior to the final order on the post-trial motion, the county did file a transfer of custody petition from my client, actually, to the grandmother. The court then said that was an error because she had issued an order terminating parental rights, but subsequent to that, that was granted. The father was found to not be able to parent full-time, and so custody was vested with the grandmother.
Father's custodial rights were transferred to his mother, correct?
He never had custodial rights. So custody was, it was phrased as a transfer of full custody. It gets very, it's an interesting legal analysis when, for example, a parent dies that is fully custodial, and then there's a presumption that the non-custodial parent would have full custody, but that the fact of the full custodial parent passing away does not automatically vest that custody with the non-custodial parent. So that's essentially the analogy when a parent loses their parental rights and there's a non-custodial parent. It was phrased as a transfer of custody. Regardless, it vested full custody with the grandmother.
Okay. I'm not sure that I fully agree or understand, but I'll let you proceed with your rebuttal argument.
Certainly, Your Honor. In a case like this, where we come down to this point of stating that a transfer of custody is the same under the eyes of the law as termination of parental rights, that does become cavalier. And respondent stated in her remarks that this was not a cavalier choice, but then immediately shifted to the point that these are equal outcomes under the law when a child is placed with a relative. What I would submit is that the district court's decision to permanently sever the parent-child relationship between appellant and her two daughters was arbitrary. It was unsupported by logic because, again, there was not a connection between why this had to happen for the children to remain safely in their grandmother's care and continue to have that relationship with their mother. And most importantly, that decision, when it doesn't create a benefit from the children, it just takes away a potentially incredibly significant resource from them for the rest of their lives. That's divorced from the humanity of the children that have to live the order that is carved out by the district court. I come before you on behalf of appellant to respectfully request that you reverse the order terminating her parental rights, because the district court abused its discretion in finding that that action, in fact, was in the best interest of the children. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for appearing today. This is, of course, an expedited matter. It is deemed submitted, and the decision will be issued in a 45-day statutory period. Thank you.